He gave me the number. I put him on hold and went back to my study. I faxed a sheet of my stationery to him while Lucy remained in front of the fire, elbow on her knee, chin in her hand, listless. "My name's Jay Talley, the ATF liaison at Interpol," he said when I got back with him. "We need you to come here right away. You and Captain Marino."
"I don't understand," I said. "You should have my reports. I have nothing more to add to them at this time."
"We wouldn't ask you if it isn't important."
"Marino doesn't have a passport," I said.
"He went to the Bahamas 3 years ago."
I had forgotten that Marino had taken one of his many bad choices in women on a 3-day cruise. Their relationship didn't last much longer than that. "I don't care how important this is," I said. "There's no way I'm getting on a plane and flying to France when I don't know what..."
"Hold on a second," he cut in, politely but with authority. "Senator Lord, sir, are you there?"
"I'm here."
"Frank?" I said in amazement. "Where are you? Are you in France?"
I wondered how long he had been conferenced in and listening.
"Now listen, Kay, this is important," Senator Lord told me in a voice that reminded me of who he was. "Go, and go right away. We need your help."
"We?"
Then Talley spoke. "You and Marino need to be at the Millionaire Private Terminal at 4:30. That's a.m., your time. Less than 6 hours from now."
"I can't leave right now," I started to say as Lucy filled my doorway.
"Don't be late. Your New York connection leaves at 8:30, he told me.
I thought Senator Lord had hung up, but suddenly his voice was there.
"Thank you, Agent Talley," he said. "I'll talk to her now."
I could hear Talley get off the line.
"I want to know how you're doing, Kay," my friend the senator said.
"I've got no idea."
"I care," he said. "I won't let anything happen to you. Just trust me. Now tell me how you're feeling."
"Other than being summoned to France and about to be fired and..." I started to add what had happened to Lucy, but she was standing right there.
"Everything's going to be fine," Senator Lord said.
"Whatever everything is," I replied.
"Trust me.
I always had."
"You're going to be asked to do things that you're going to resist. Things that will scare you."
"I don't scare easily, Frank," I said.
31.
Marino picked me up at 4:15. It was a heartless hour of the morning that reminded me of sleepless rotations in hospitals, of early days in my career when I was the one who got the calls for cases nobody else wanted.
"Now you know what it feels like to be on midnight shift," Marino commented as we cut through icy roads.
"I know all about it anyway," I replied.
"Yeah, but the difference is you don't have to. You could send someone else to scenes and stay home. You're the chief."
"I'm always leaving Lucy when she needs me, Marino."
"I'm telling you, Doc, she understands. She's probably gonna be heading up to D.C. anyway to deal with all this review board shit."
I hadn't told him about Dorothy's visit. It would serve no purpose other than to set him off.
"You're on the faculty at MCV. I mean, you're a real doctor."
"Thank you."
"Can't you just go talk to the administrator or something?" he said, punching in the cigarette lighter. "Couldn't you pull some strings so Lucy could go in there?"
"As long as Joe isn't capable of making decisions, her family has complete control over who visits and who doesn't."
"Fucking religious wackos. Bible-banging Hitlers."
"There was a time when you were pretty narrow-minded, too, Marino," I reminded him. "Seems to me you used to talk about queers and fags. I don't even want to repeat some of the words I've heard you use."
"Yeah, well, I never meant any of it."
At the Millionaire Jet Center, the temperature was in the low 20s, and hard, icy wind grabbed and shoved me as I collected luggage out of the back of the truck. We were met by two pilots who didn't say much as they opened a gate to lead us across the tarmac, where a Learjet was hooked up to a power cart. A thick manila envelope with my name on it was in one of the seats, and when we took off into the clear, cold night, I turned off cabin lights and slept until we landed in Teterboro, New Jersey. A dark blue Explorer glided our way as we climbed down the metal steps. It was snowing small flakes that stung my face.
"Cop,"
Marino gave the nod, as the Explorer stopped close to the plane.
"How do you know?"
"I always know," he said.
The driver was in jeans and a leather coat and looked as if he'd seen life from every angle and was happy to pick us up. He packed our baggage in the trunk. Marino climbed in front, and off they sailed into one comment and story after another, because the driver was NYPD and Marino used to be. I floated in and out of their conversation as I dozed.
"Adam's in the detective division. He called around 11. I guess Interpol got him first. I didn't know he had anything to do with them."
"Oh, yeah?" Marino's voice was muted and soporific, like bourbon on the rocks.
"Some tear-ass, I bet. Nah, he's okay."
I slept and drifted, city lights touching my eyelids as I began to feel that empty ache again.
Got so shit-faced one night I woke up the next morning and didn't know where my car or creds were. That was my wake-up call.
The only other time I had flown supersonic had been with Benton. I remembered his body against me, the intense heat of my breasts touching him as we sat in those small gray leather seats and drank French wine, staring at jars of caviar we had no intention of eating. I remembered exchanging hurtful words that turned into desperate lovemaking in London, in a flat near the American Embassy. Maybe Dorothy was right. Maybe sometimes I was too much in my mind and not as open as I wanted to be. But she was wrong about Benton. He had never been weak, and we had never been tepid in bed.
"Dr. Scarpetta?"
A voice grabbed my attention.
"We're here,"
our driver said, eyeing me in the rearview window. I rubbed my face with my hands and stifled a yawn. Winds were stronger here, the temperature lower. At the Air France ticket counter, I checked us in because I didn't trust Marino with tickets or passports or even finding the right gate without being an ass. Flight 2 left in about an hour and a half, and the instant I sat down in the Concorde lounge, I felt exhausted again, my eyes burning. Marino was in awe.
"Look at that, will you?"
he whispered too loudly.
"They got a full bar! That guy over there's drinking a beer, and it's 7 o'clock in the morning!"
Marino took that as his wake-up call.
"Want anything?" he asked. "How about a newspaper?"
"Right now I don't give a damn what's going on in the world." I wished he would leave me alone. When he returned, he was carrying 2 plates piled high with Danish, cheese, and crackers. He had a can of Heineken under an arm.
"Guess what?" he said, setting his breakfast snack on the coffee table next to him. "It's almost 4 o'clock in the afternoon, French time."
He popped open the beer.
"They got people mixing champagne and orange juice. You ever heard of that? And I'm pretty sure there's somebody famous sitting over there. She's got sunglasses on and everybody's staring."
I didn't care.
"The guy she's with looks famous too, sort of like Mel Brooks."
"Does the woman in sunglasses look like Anne Bancroft?" I muttered.
"Yeah."
"Then it's Mel Brooks." Other passengers, dressed far more expensively than we were, glanced our way. A man rattled Le Monde and sipped espresso.
"Saw her in The Graduate. You remember that?" Marino went on.
I was awake now and wished I could hide somewhere.
"That was my fantasy. Shit. Like that schoolteacher giving you tutoring after hours. The one who made you cross your legs."
"You can see the Concorde through the window over there," I pointed.
"I can't believe I didn't bring a camera."
He swallowed another mouthful of beer.
"Maybe you should go find one," I suggested. "You think they'd have those little disposable cameras around here?"
"Only French ones." He hesitated for a moment, then gave me a dirty look.
"I'll be back," he said.
Of course, he left his ticket and passport in the pocket of the coat draped over his chair, and when the announcement came that we were about to board, I got an urgent text message on my pager that no one would let him back inside the lounge. He was waiting at the desk, face flushed with anger, a security guard beside him. "Sorry," I said, handing one of the attendants Marino's passport and ticket. "Let's not begin the trip this way," I said to him under my breath as we walked back through the lounge, following other passengers to the plane.
"I told them I'd go get it, bunch of French sons of bitches. If people would speak English like they're supposed to, this kind of shit wouldn't happen."
Our seats were together, but fortunately the plane wasn't full, so I moved across the aisle from him. He seemed to take this personally until I gave him half of my chicken with lime sauce, my sponge roll with vanilla mousse, and my chocolates. I had no idea how many beers he drank, but he was up and down a lot, making his way along the narrow aisle while we flew twice the speed of sound. We arrived at Charles de Gaulle Airport at 6:20 p.m. A dark blue Mercedes was waiting for us outside the terminal, and Marino tried to strike up a conversation with the driver, who would neither let him sit in the front seat nor pay any attention to him. Marino sullenly smoked out his window, cold air washing in as he watched abject apartments scarred with graffiti and miles of switchyards draw us up into a lit-up skyline of a modern city. The great corporate gods of Hertz, Honda, Technics, and Toshiba glittered in the night from their Mount Olympian heights. "Hell, this may as well be Chicago," Marino complained. "I feel really weird." "Jet lag. I've been to the West Coast before and didn't feel like this." "This is worse, jet lag," I said. "I think it's got something to do with going that fast," he went on. "Think about it. You're looking out this little porthole like you're in a spaceship, right? You can't even see the damn horizon. No clouds that high. Air's too thin to breathe. Probably 100 degrees below zero. No birds, no normal planes, no nothing." A police officer in a blue and white Citroën with red stripes was pulling a speeder near the Banque de France. Along Boulevard des Capucines, shops turned into designer boutiques for the very rich, and I was reminded that I had failed to find out the exchange rate. "That's why I'm hungry again," Marino continued his scientific explanation. "Your metabolism's got to pick up when you're going that fast. Think how many calories that is. I didn't feel nothing once I got through customs, did you? Not drunk or stuffed or nothing." Not much decorating has been done for Christmas, not even in the heart of the city. Parisians had strung modest lights and swags of evergreen outside their bistros and shops, and so far I had seen not a single Santa, except the tall, inflatable one in the airport that was flapping his arms as if he were doing calisthenics. The season was celebrated a bit more with poinsettias and a Christmas tree in the marble lobby of the Grand Hotel, where our itinerary let us know we were staying. "Holy shit," Marino said, looking around at columns and at a huge chandelier. "What do you think a room in this joint costs?" The musical trilling of telephones was non-stop, the line at the reception desk depressingly long. Baggage was parked everywhere, and I realized with growing despondency that a tour group was checking in. "You know what, Doc?" Marino said. "I won't even be able to afford a beer in this place." "If you ever make it to the bar," I replied. "It looks like we may be here all night." Just as I said that, someone touched my arm, and I found a man in a dark suit standing next to me, smiling. "Madame Scarpetin, Monsieur Marino." He motioned us out of line. "I'm so sorry. I just now saw you. My name is Ivan. You're already checked in. Please, I will show you to your rooms." I couldn't place his accent, but it certainly wasn't French. He led us through the lobby to mirror-polished brass elevators where he pushed the button for the third floor. "Where are you from?" I asked. "All over. But I have been in Paris many years." We followed him down a long hallway to rooms that were next to each other but not connected. I was startled and unnerved to find our baggage was already inside them. "If you need anything, call for me specifically," Ivan said. "It's probably best you eat in the café here. There's a table for you, or of course there's room service." He briskly walked away before I could tip him. Marino and I both stood in our doorways staring inside our rooms. "This is weirding me out," he said. "I don't like secret squirrel shit like this. How the hell do we know who he is? I bet he don't even work for this hotel." "Marino, let's not have this conversation in the hall," I said quietly. I thought if I did not have even a few moments away from him, I might become violent. "So, when you want to eat?" "How about I call your room?" I said. "Well, I'm really hungry." "Why don't you go on to the café, Marino?" I suggested, praying he would. "I'll get something later." "No, I think we better stick together, Doc," he replied. I walked inside my room and shut the door, astonished to discover my suitcase unpacked, my clothes neatly folded and already in drawers. Slacks, shirts, and a suit were hanging in the closet, toiletries lined up on the counter in the bathroom. Instantly, my phone rang. I had no doubt who it was. "What?" I said.
"They got into my shit and put everything away," Marino blared like a radio turned up too high. "Now I've about had it. I don't like nobody digging in my bags. Who the hell they think they are over here? This some French custom or something? You check into a ritzy hotel and they go through your luggage?"
"No, it's not a French custom," I said.
"So it must be some Interpol custom," he retorted.
"I'll call you later." A fruit basket and bottle of wine centered a table, and I sliced a blood orange and poured a glass of Merlot. I pulled back heavy drapes and stared out the window at people in evening dress getting into fine cars. Gilt sculptures on the old opera house across the street flaunted their golden naked beauty before the gods, and chimney pots were dark stubble on miles of roofs. I felt anxious and lonely and intruded upon. I took a long bath and thought about abandoning Marino for the rest of the night, but decency overruled. He had never been to Europe before, certainly not to Paris, and more to the point, I was afraid of leaving him alone. I dialed his extension and asked if he wanted to have a light dinner sent up. He picked pizza, despite my warning that Paris wasn't known for it, and he raided my minibar for beer. I ordered oysters on the half shell and nothing more, and turned the lights very low because I'd seen enough for one day.
"There's something I've been thinking about," he said after the food had arrived. "I don't like to bring it up, Doc, but I'm getting a really oddball feeling. Odd as hell. I mean, well," he took a bite of pizza, "I'm just wondering if you're feeling it too, if the same thing might be floating in your head, sort of out of nowhere like a UFO.
I put down my fork. The lights of the city sparkled beyond my windows, and even in the dim lighting I could see his fear. I responded in kind. "I haven't a clue as to what you're talking about," I said, reaching for my wine.
"Okay, I just think we need to consider something for a minute."
I didn't want to listen.
"Well, first you get this letter delivered by a United States senator who just happens to be the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, meaning he's got about as much power with federal law enforcement as any other person I can think of. Meaning he's gonna know all kinds of shit going on with Secret Service, ATF, FBI, you name it."
An alarm began to sound inside me.
"You gotta admit, it's interesting timing that Senator Lord delivers this letter to you from Benton, and now all of a sudden we're over here going to Interpol."
"Let's don't do this," I cut him off, as my stomach tightened and my heart began to pound.
"You gotta hear me out, Doc," he replied. "In the letter, Benton's saying for you to stop grieving, that everything's all right and he knows what you're doing right this minute. Stop it!"
I raised my voice and threw my napkin on the table as emotions began crashing in on all sides.
"We got to face it!"
Marina was getting emotional, too.
"How do you know? I mean, what if the letter really wasn't written several years ago? What if it was written now? No! How dare you!"
I exclaimed as tears filled my eyes. I pushed back my chair and got up.
"Leave," I told him. "I won't be subjected to your goddamn UFO theories. What do you want? To make me live through this hell all over again? So I can hope something when I've worked so hard to accept the truth? Get out of my room!"
Marino pushed back his chair, and it fell over as he jumped to his feet. He snatched his pack of cigarettes off the table.
"What if he's fucking still alive?"
He raised his voice, too.
"How do you know for a fact he didn't have to disappear for a while because of some big thing going on that involves ATF, FBI, Interpol, shit, maybe NASA for all we know?"
I grabbed my wine, my hands shaking so badly I could barely hold it without spilling, my entire existence ripped open again. Marino was stalking the room and gesturing wildly with his cigarette.
"You don't know it for a fact," he said again. "All you saw was burned-up bone in a stinking black fire hole, and a Breitling watch like his. So fucking what?" "You son of a bitch," I said. "You goddamn son of a bitch. After all I've been through, and then you have to..." "You're not the only one who's been through it. You know, just because you slept with him doesn't mean you fucking owned him."
I took quick steps toward him and caught myself before I slapped him hard across the face. "Oh, God," I muttered as I stared into his shocked eyes. "Oh, God." I thought of Lucy striking Joe, and I walked away from him. He turned to the window and smoked. The room was overcast with misery and shame, and I leaned my head against the wall and shut my eyes. I'd never come even close to violence with anyone in my life, not anyone like this, not someone I knew and cared about. "Nietzsche was right," I muttered in a defeated way. "Be careful who you choose for an enemy, because that's who you become most like." "I'm sorry," Marino barely said. "Like my first husband, like my idiot sister, like every out-of-control, cruel, selfish person I've ever known, here I am, like them." "No, you ain't." My forehead was pressed against the wall as if I were praying, and I was grateful we were in shadows, my back to him, so he could not see my anguish. "I didn't mean what I said, Doc. I swear I didn't. I don't even know why I said it."
"It's all right. All I'm trying to do is look at everything because there's pieces that aren't fitting right."
He walked over to an ashtray and stabbed out his cigarette.
"I don't know why we're here," he said.
"We're not here to do this," I said.
"Well, I don't know why they couldn't have exchanged info with us through the computer over the phone like they always do, do you?"
"No,"
I whispered as I took a deep breath. "So it started sneaking into my thoughts that maybe Benton... What if there was something going on and he had to be a protected witness for a while, change his identity and all that? We didn't always know what he was into. Not even you always knew, because he couldn't always tell you, and he would never want to hurt us by telling us something we shouldn't know. Especially not hurt you or make you worry about him all the time."
I did not answer him.
"I'm not trying to stir anything up. I'm just saying it's something we should think about," he lamely added.
"No, it isn't," I replied, clearing my throat and aching all over.
"It's not something we should think about. He was identified, Marino, by every possible means. Cary Gresson didn't just conveniently kill him so he could disappear for a while. Don't you see how impossible this is?
He's dead, Marino.
He's dead." "Did you go to his autopsy? Did you see his autopsy report?"
"He wouldn't let it go."
"Benton's remains had gone to the Philadelphia Medical Examiner's office. I had never asked to review his case." "No, you didn't go to his autopsy, and if you had, I would have thought you were the most fucked-up person I have ever met," Marino said. "So you didn't see nothing. You only know what you've been told. I don't mean to keep hammering you with that, but it's the truth. And if anyone wanted to cover up that those remains weren't his, how would you know if you never took a look?"
"Poor Miss Scotch," I said.
32. I turned toward Marino, my back against the wall, as if I didn't have the strength to stand on my own 2 feet.
"Man, you see how much whiskey costs over here?"
Marino commented as he closed the door to the minibar. "I don't care."
"Interpol's probably paying anyway," he decided.
"And I need a cigarette," I added.
He lit a Marlboro for me, and the first hit punched my lungs. He presented me with a tumbler of straight single malt on the rocks in one hand, a Beck's beer in the other.
"What I'm trying to say," Marino resumed, "is if Interpol can do all this secret shit with electronic tickets and ritzy hotels and Concords, and no one ever meets a soul who's ever talked to whoever these people are, then what makes you think they couldn't have faked everything else?"
"They couldn't have faked his being murdered by a psychopath," I replied.
"Yes, they could have. Maybe that was the perfect timing."
He blew out smoke and gulped down beer.
"Point is, Doc, I think anything can be faked if you think about it."
"DNA identified..."
I couldn't finish the statement. It brought images before me I had suppressed for so long. "You can't say the reports were true." "Enough!"
But the beer had crumbled what walls he had, and he would not stop his increasingly fantastic theories and deductions and wishful thoughts. His voice went on and began to sound far away and unreal. A shiver crept over me. A splinter of light glinted in that dark, devastated part of me. I desperately wanted to believe that what he was suggesting was true. When 5 a.m. came around, I was still dressed and asleep on the couch. I had a hammering headache. My mouth tasted like stale cigarettes, and my breath was alcohol. I showered and stared for a long time at the phone by my bed. The anticipation of what I had decided to do electrified me with panic. I was so confused. In Philadelphia, it was almost midnight, and I left a message for Dr. Vance Harston, the chief medical examiner. I gave him the number to the fax machine in my room and left the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. Marino met me in the hall, and I said nothing to him but an inaudible good morning. Downstairs, dishes clattered as the buffet was set up, and a man cleaned glass doors with a brush and a cloth. There was no coffee this early, and the only other guest awake was a woman with a mink coat draped over a chair. In front of the hotel, another Mercedes taxi awaited us. Our driver this day was sullen and in a hurry. I rubbed my temples as motorcycles sped past in lanes of their imagination, weaving between cars and roaring through many narrow tunnels. I was depressed by reminders of the car crash that killed Princess Diana. I remembered waking up and hearing about it on the news, and my first thought was we tended to disbelieve that mundane, random deaths can happen to our gods. There is no glory or nobility in being killed by a drunk driver. Death is the great equalizer. It doesn't give a damn who you are. The sky was dusky blue. Sidewalks were wet from washing, and green garbage cans had been set out along the streets. We bumped over cobblestone at Place de la Concorde and drove along the Seine, which we could not see most of the time because of a wall. A digital clock outside the Gare de Lyon let us know it was 7:20, and inside feet shuffled and people hurried into Relais Hachette to buy papers. I waited behind a woman with a poodle at the ticket counter, and a sharp-featured, well-dressed man with silver hair jolted me. He looked like Benton from a distance. I could not help but scan the crowd as if I might find him, my heart throbbing as if it couldn't survive much more of this. "Coffee," I told Marino. We sat at a counter inside L'Embarcadère, and were served espresso in tiny brown cups. "The hell is this?" Marino grumbled. "I just wanted regular coffee." "How about handing me some sugar?" he said to the woman behind the counter. She dropped several packs on the counter. "I think he'd rather have a café crème," I told her. She nodded. He drank four of them and ate two ham baguettes and smoked three cigarettes in less than 20 minutes. "You know," I said to him, as we boarded Train à Grande Vitesse, or TGV, "I really don't want you to kill yourself." "Hey, not to worry," he replied, taking a seat across from me. "If I tried to clean up my act, the stress would do me in." Our car was barely a third full, and those passengers seemed interested only in their newspapers. The silence prompted Marino and me to speak in very low voices, and the bullet train made no sound as it suddenly lurched forward. We glided out at the station, then blue sky and trees were flying by. I felt flushed and very thirsty. I tried to sleep, sunlight flashing over my shut eyes. I came to when an Englishwoman two rows back began talking on a portable phone. An old man across the aisle was working on a crossword puzzle, his mechanical pencil clicking. Air buffeted our car as another train sped by, and near Lyon the sky turned milky and it began to snow. Marino's mood was getting increasingly curdled as he stared out the window, and he was rude when we disembarked in the Lyon Pardieu. He had nothing to say during our taxi ride, and I got angrier with him as I replayed the words he had recklessly thrown at me last night. We neared the old part of the city where the Rhone and Saône rivers joined, and apartments and ancient walls built into the hillside reminded me of Rome. I felt awful. My soul was bruised. I felt as alone as I'd ever felt in my life, as if I didn't exist, as if I were part of another person's bad dream. "I don't hope nothing," Marino finally spoke, apropos of nothing. "I might say what if, but I don't hope. There's no point. My wife left me a long time ago, and I've still never found anybody that fits. Now I'm suspended and thinking about working for you. I did that, you wouldn't respect me anymore." "Of course I would." "Bullshit. Working for someone changes everything, and you know it." He looked dejected and exhausted, his face and slumped posture showing the strain of the life he'd lived. He'd spilled coffee on his rumpled denim shirt, and his khakis were ridiculously baggy. I noticed that the bigger he got, the larger the size of the pants he bought, as if he fooled himself or anyone else. "You know, Marino, it's not very nice to imply that working for me would be the worst thing that ever happened to you."
"Maybe it wouldn't be the worst thing, but pretty close," he said.
33. Interpol's headquarters stood alone on the Parc de la Tête d'Or. It was a fortress of reflective pools and glass and did not look like what it was. I was certain the subtle signs of what went on inside were missed by virtually all who drove past. The name of the plantain tree-lined street where it was located wasn't posted, so if you didn't know where you were going, you quite likely would never get there. There was no sign out front announcing Interpol. In fact, there were no signs anywhere. Satellite dishes, antennas, concrete barricades, and cameras were very hard to see, and the razor-wire-topped green metal fence was well disguised by landscaping. The secretariat for the only international police organization in the world silently emanated enlightenment and peace, appropriately allowing those who worked inside to look out and no one to look in. On this overcast, cold morning, a small Christmas tree on the roof ironically tipped its hat to the holidays. I saw no one when I pressed the intercom button on the front gate to say we had arrived. Then a voice asked us to identify ourselves, and when we did, a lock clicked free. Marino and I followed a sidewalk to an outbuilding, where another lock released, and we were met by a guard in suit and tie, who looked strong enough to snatch up Marino and hurl him back to Paris. Another guard sat behind bulletproof glass and slid out a drawer to exchange our passports for visitor badges. A belt carried our personal effects through an X-ray machine, and the guard who had greeted us gave us instructions with gestures rather than words to step, one at a time, inside what looked like a floor-to-ceiling transparent pneumatic tube. I complied, halfway expecting to be sucked up somewhere, and a curved plexiglass door shut. Another one released me on the other side, every molecule of me scanned.
"What the hell is this? Star Trek?" Marino said to me after he'd been scanned, too. "How you know something like that can't give you cancer? Or if you're a man, give you other problems?" "Be quiet," I said.
It seemed we waited a very long time before a man appeared on a breezeway connecting the secure area to the main building, and he was not at all what I expected. He walked with the easy spring of a youthful athlete, and an expensive charcoal flannel suit draped elegantly over what was clearly a sculpted body. He wore a crisp white shirt and a rich Hermes tie in maroon, green, and blue, and when he firmly shook our hands, I noticed a gold watch, too.
"Jay Talley, sorry to make you wait," he said.
His hazel eyes were so penetrating I felt violated by them. His dark good looks so striking I instantly knew his type, because men that beautiful are all alike. I could tell Marino had no use for him either.
"We spoke on the phone," he said to me as if I didn't remember.
"And I haven't slept since," I said, unable to take my eyes off him, no matter how hard I tried.
"Please, if you'll come with me."
Marino gave me a look and wiggled his fingers behind Tally's back, the way he did when he decided on the spot that someone was gay. Tally's shoulders were broad. He had no waist. His profile had the perfect slope of a Roman god, and his lips were full and his jaw was flared. I concentrated on being puzzled by his age. Usually overseas posts were much coveted and were awarded to agents with seniority and rank, yet Tally looked barely 30. He led us into a marble atrium 4 stories high that was centered by a brilliant mosaic of the world and washed in light. Even the elevators were glass. After a series of electronic locks and buzzers and combinations and cameras that cared about our every move, we got off on the 3rd floor. I felt as if I were inside cut crystal. Tally seemed to blaze. I felt dazed and resentful because it hadn't been my idea to come here, and I didn't feel in charge.
"So what's up there?"
Marino, the model of politeness, pointed. "The 4th floor," Tally impassively said.
"Well, the button don't have a number, and it looks like you have to key yourself up," Marino went on, staring at the elevator ceiling. I was just wondering if that's where you keep all your computers.
The Secretary General lives up there, Tally matter-of-factly stated, as if there were nothing unusual about this.
No shit?
For security reasons. He and his family live in the building, Tally said as we passed normal-looking offices with normal-looking people inside them. We're meeting him now.
Good. Maybe he won't mind telling me what the hell we're doing here,
Marino replied. Tally opened another door, this one made of rich, dark wood, and we were politely greeted by a man with a British accent who identified himself as the Director of Communication. He took orders for coffee and let Secretary General George Miro know we had arrived. Minutes later, he showed us into Miro's private office, where we found an imposing gray-haired man seated behind a black leather desk, amid walls of antique guns and medals and gifts from other countries. Miro got up and shook our hands.
"Let's be comfortable," he said.
He showed us to a sitting area before a window overlooking the Rhone, while Tally collected a thick accordion file from a table.
"I know this has been quite an ordeal, and I'm sure you must be exhausted," he said in precise English. "I can't thank you enough for coming, especially on such short notice."
His inscrutable face and military bearing revealed nothing, and his presence seemed to make everything around him smaller. He settled into a wing chair and crossed his legs. Marino and I chose the couch, and Tally sat across from me, setting the file on the rug.
"Agent Tally," Miro said, "I'll let you start. You'll excuse me if I get right to the point."
He directed this at us.
"We have very little time. First, I want to explain why ATF's involved in your unidentified case," Tally said to Marino and me. "You're familiar with HIDTA, because of your niece Lucy, perhaps?"
"This has nothing to do with her," I assumed uneasily.
"As you probably know, HIDTA has violent crimes fugitive task forces," he said, instead of answering my question. "FBI, DEA, local law enforcement, and of course ATF, combining resources in high priority, especially difficult cases."
He pulled up a chair and sat across from me.
"About a year ago," he went on, "we formed a squad to work murders in Paris we believed are being committed by the same individual."
"I'm not aware of any serial murders in Paris," I said.
"In France, we control the media better than you do," the Secretary General commented. "You must understand the murders have been in the news, Dr. Scarpetta, but in very little detail. No sensationalizing. Parisians know there's a murderer out there, and women have been warned not to open their doors to strangers and so on. But that's all. We believe it serves no good to reveal the gore, the shattered bones, torn clothes, bite marks, sexual deviations."
"Where did the name Loup-Garou come from?" I asked.
"From him," Tally said, as his eyes almost touched my body and flew off like a bird.
"From the killer?" I asked.
"You mean he calls himself a werewolf?"
"Yes."
"How the hell can you know something like that?"
Marino elbowed his way in, and I knew by his body language that he was about to cause trouble. Tally hesitated and glanced at Miro.
"What's the son of a bitch been doing?" Marino continued. "Leaving his nickname on little notes at the scenes? Maybe he pins them to the bodies like in the movies, huh? That's what I hate about big organizations getting involved in crap like this. The best people to work crimes is the schmucks like me out there walking around getting our boots muddy. Once you get these big-shot task forces and computer systems involved, the whole thing gets off in the ozone. It gets too smart when what started the whole ball rolling ain't smart in the college sense of the word."
"That's where you're quite mistaken," Miro cut him off.
"Loup-Garou is very smart. He had his self-serving reasons to let us know his name in a letter."
"A letter to who?" Marino wanted to know.
"To me,"
Tally said. "When was this?" I asked.
"About a year ago, after his fourth murder."
He untied the file and pulled out a letter protected by a plastic. He handed it to me, his fingers brushing against mine. The letter was in French. I recognized the handwriting as the same strange, box-like style I'd found on the carton inside the container. The stationery was engraved with a woman's name, the paper smeared with blood. "It says," Tally translated, "for the sins of one shall they all die, the werewolf." The stationery belonged to the victim, and it's her blood. But what mystified me at the time was how he knew I was involved in the investigation. And this all moves us closer to a theory that's the root of why you're here. We have ample reason to believe the killer is from a powerful family, the son of people who know exactly what he's doing and have made certain he doesn't get caught. Not necessarily because they give a damn about him, but because they must do whatever's necessary to protect themselves. Including shipping him off in a container? I asked. Dead and unidentified, thousands of miles from Paris because they've had enough? Miro studied me, leather creaking as he shifted his position in his chair and stroked a silver pen. Probably not, Tally said to me. At first, yes. That's what we thought, because every indicator pointed to the dead man in Richmond as this killer. Loup-garou written on the carton, the physical description as best you could tell, considering the state the body was in, the expensive way he was dressed. But when you supplied us with further information about the tattoo with, quote, yellow eyes that might have been altered in an attempt to make them smaller...
Whoa, Marino cut in. You saying this Garou guy's got a tattoo with yellow eyes?
No, Tally replied. We're saying his brother did.
Did?
I asked. We'll get to that, and maybe you'll begin to pick up on why what happened to your niece is tangentially connected with all this, Tally said, filling me with torment again.
Are you familiar with an international criminal cartel we've come to call the 165ers?
Oh, God, I said. Named such because they seem to be very fond of 165-grain spear gold dot ammo, Tally explained. They smuggle the stuff. They use it exclusively in their own guns, and we can generally tell their hits because gold dot's going to be the bullet recovered. I thought of the gold dot cartridge case recovered from the quick carry.
When you sent us information about Kim Luong's murder, and thank God you did, pieces began to fit together, Tally said.
Then Miro spoke.
All members of this cartel are tattooed with two bright yellow dots.
He drew them on a legal pad. They were the size of dimes.
A symbol of membership in a powerful, violent club, and a reminder that once in, you're in for life, because tattoos don't come off. The only way out of the 165er cartel is death.
Unless you are able to make the gold dots smaller and turn them into eyes. A small owl's eyes, so simple and so quick. Then escape to some place where nobody will think to look for you.
Like a niche port in the unlikely city of Richmond, Virginia, Tally added.
Miro nodded.
Exactly.
What for? Marino asked. Why suddenly does this guy freak out and run? What's he done?
He's crossed the cartel, Tally replied. He'd betrayed his family, in other words.